yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we're going to do a year-end review of the U.S. and global economy, as well as predictions for both in the coming year. And if we have time, we'll talk about related political main events of the past year and some predictions. Let's jump right into it here this week. What are the key economic events of the past year? And which have staying power going into 2017 and will have an impact continuing in 2017. Okay. Not necessarily by weight or importance here. Let's start with global trade stagnation. The global economy has been slowing down step by step over the last several years. In other words, the volume of export-import trade has been declining, and it's just about stagnant now. Related to that is a decline in real asset investment. In other words, an investment that creates real jobs, manufacturing jobs and construction jobs, etc. That's been in decline as well. And it's not strange that the two are related, because most of the economies of the world depend upon a lot of exports, and if export trade and imports are declining, well, then the production of that will decline, those goods and services, and if production is declining, then so is real investment going to decline. And we've seen that, and eventually even it has an effect on the prices of real goods and services. We see deflation drift towards the deflation that had been occurring. Okay, global trade stagnation is a major issue, particularly for most of the rest of the global economy. And that's one of the key economic events of the past year, and we'll probably see that stagnation continuing, although there may be some brief suspension of the trend here, which we'll talk about. Okay, the other major event of the past year right here at home, the Federal Reserve raising interest rates, short-term rates here, in just a few weeks ago in December. Only the second time in a decade. Last December, they raised rates 0.25%, short-term rates, and that contributed significantly to a near collapse of the U.S. economy in the first quarter of earlier this year, 2016, which was the fourth relapse. I call these one-quarter collapses relapses. They're not recessions, but they're relapses. We see a dramatic decline in the rate of GDP growth and economic activity for one quarter, and then it tends to pick up temporarily. We've seen four of these since 2008-09 in the U.S. Elsewhere in the world, the retractions or contractions are not relapses, they're recessions occurring for two quarters or more of stagnant or declining growth. But in the U.S., we see short-term rates here, another big event of this past year, being raised by the U.S. Federal Reserve. Now, that's not really the big story in rates. It's long-term interest rates that the Federal Reserve central banks can't control, driven by general economic conditions. Well, long-term rates have been rising even before the Fed raised short-term rates. And that's been having that rise in the long-term rates has been causing the dollar to appreciate in the U.S., which together with rates has a big effect on the rest of the global economies, which we'll talk about. But, okay, long-term rate increases, interest rate U.S., and short-term rate increases. Now, short-term and long-term are related to each other. They tend to eventually drag and pull each other up. So the short-term rate increase is putting pressure on rising long-term rates, and as long-term rates rise, they tend to drag up short-term rates. The Fed can hold off for a while, but they can't indefinitely if long-term rates are rising. Okay, so the Fed had its meeting here and raised rates another 0.25% short-term, the federal funds rate, and declared there'd be three more coming next year. Well, if they do come through, the impact will be significant, not just on other economies, but globally here, because the Fed is the central bank of central banks now. Globally, you know, what the other central banks in the world key on what the Fed is doing. We can see that very well in what's going on in Europe, you know, with the European Central Bank and Bank of Japan. They will take action to raise or lower their rates by money supply changes based on what the Fed does. Well, the Fed's raising rates now. So it takes the pressure off of Bank of Japan and the European Central Bank to try to drive down their interest rates even further. In desperation, they had driven it down, driven interest rates on government securities down to a negative territory. That was causing some real problems, driving rates, interest rates into negative rates. And we had quite a few negative rates for some time here throughout 2016, particularly in Europe and Japan. That is being reversed a little bit as U.S. raises rates, takes the pressure off of Japan and Europe to lower their rates. And why do they lower the rates? Well, in desperation to try to get their currencies down in value, and that theoretically gives their exports a little advantage, competitive advantage, and they can sell more exports. And since most of these economies elsewhere outside the U.S. are so dependent on exports much more than we are, what that results in is a stimulation, they think, of their domestic economies. But export-driven policies are not working because the global economy is slowing down. So it hasn't been very, very successful. But the federal rate increase, short-term and rising long-term rates, takes the pressure off of Europe to drive down their interest rates. And you can see it in their central bank policies recently. They're kind of holding off of deepening what's called quantitative easing. In other words, injecting massive liquidity into their economies to lower their interest rates that would then also would depress their currency values, stimulate exports and production, GDP. Okay. Third major development that we see the past year is the stabilization of global oil and commodity prices. This last few months here, OPEC is thrown in the towel. Saudi Arabia and his friends in OPEC are trying to bankrupt the fracking industry, oil fracking industry in the U.S., and therefore allow it, OPEC, to get control once again over global oil prices. See, OPEC no longer controls global oil prices because you've got massive production of oil out of Russia and the fracking industry in the U.S. All of these three, you know, Saudi Arabia, OPEC, Saudi Arabia, the U.S., and Russia produce now about the same amount of global oil. And the Saudis attempted and continued into 2016 to try to drive the fracking companies in the U.S. out of business and therefore gain control of the supply of oil. Well, it didn't work. Oil went down to $26 a barrel here at the beginning of the year, or late last year, beginning of this year. but it's risen back up to the mid-50s. One of the reasons of it rising to the mid-50s is the deal that was just struck and been underway for a couple months here between OPEC and Russia to finally, instead of pumping more oil, reduce the supply of oil and therefore get the price of oil up as the supply declines. Prior to that, OPEC and Saudis in particular were pumping even more oil as the global economy was slowing to depress the price of a barrel of oil to drive below the cost of production for the fracking companies in the U.S. Well, it didn't work. The fracking companies employed technology to reduce their cost even further, temporarily put some wells sort of held up the production of some wells, you know, put them in inventory, and they can open those real quick, which is what they're doing now. So we've got global oil around $50, $50, $55 a barrel, down from 120, but up from 26. That stabilized some of the impacts on countries that are, you know, deeply dependent on oil sales, you know, like Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, and some others. And so we see a stabilization of that over the past year here. Fourthly, renewed property bubbles, real estate bubbles, and financial asset bubbles in China. As I've written in my book, Systemic Fragility and Global Economy, the chapter on China, the main theme is that China has been experiencing rotating financial bubbles ever since it stimulated their economy with massive bank liquidity injections to accommodate their 15% fiscal stimulus in 2009. But they just kept doing it after 2009-10. And they gave rise to a domestic shadow banking industry of speculators. And we've been seeing rotating bubbles. First, the bubbles in the local real estate property prices, both commercial and housing prices, because of the way they were funded by local investment vehicles. Local city, county, region investment vehicles generated a bubble there. And in 2014-15, the Chinese government attempted to gain control over the bubble by stimulating the stock market, Chinese stock markets. The idea was to get the excess liquidity and speculation out of real estate and have it move into the stock market. And the thought was, well, if we can get the stock prices up, maybe we'll get more private domestic investment up. Well, what they got was more speculation in stocks. And we had that bubble in stocks. The Chinese stock market, the Shenzhen market, doubled, and then it collapsed. Right? And where did the money go? Well, the money tried to go offshore, the Chinese government blocked a lot of it in some ways. Trying to keep it onshore. Well, it stayed onshore, but where did it go? It went into asset management products, which are a bubble, and also went back into real estate once again. So we have these rotating bubbles in China that are going to continue. Most recently, the government has stepped in once again for a third time, because this is the third property bubble, has put in place certain policies to increase the supply of land and lower property prices, and also discourage excess demand by speculators for property. But China continues to struggle with shadow banks and speculators. That's because there's so much liquidity floating around. In my book, Systemic Fragility, I talk about that. The explosion of liquidity is the main problem, and one of the main problems in the global economy. Just too much liquid money, assets floating around there. It's got to go somewhere, so it creates this shadow banking and new finance capital elite, and they create these new markets and these new securities of trade, and you got technology and deregulation and no controls on international capital flow. So what happens? The money just sloshes around globally. Well, China has controls on it sloshing out of the country, and not so good on preventing money flowing in, but flowing out. So the money just sloshes around within China, within these different financial asset markets and bubbles that have been occurring. China is also, in the past year, struggling with preventing capital flight, money moving out. You know, when these financial bubbles collapse, the money tries to flee. And to some extent, it was able to do so, hundreds of billions of dollars, particularly after the stock market bubble collapsed. And what that does is put pressure on the currency, the yuan, as people try to sell the yuan to get their money into other currencies, take it out. And the yuan, Chinese currency, is pegged to the dollar in a range of 6.2 to 6.9 to the dollar. Well, it's up at its top range, 6.9, and looks like it can't hold that, and there will be a further devaluation. China is trying to prevent that devaluation. It's buying up currencies, including its own, and instituting controls on capital, money capital movements and so forth, to plug the collapse of the stock market and this currency flight. The Chinese government has spent close to $1 trillion of its reserves, its currency reserves, in order to stop the flight and stop the collapse of these financial markets too fast. Well, it has about $3 trillion of currency reserves of various kinds. Well, it spent about $1 trillion of that, and that can't go on forever. It can go on for some time more, but at some point, China, if this all continues, China will start preserving its currency reserves, and that's when you will see an intensification of capital flight and currency devaluation. Now, on top of this, part of this liquidity injection, massive liquidity injection in China, why is it occurring? Well, because you have a lot of state-owned enterprises that are technically insolvent, in other words, bankrupt, and the government's been keeping them afloat with bank loans. As a result, corporate debt in China has escalated rapidly, and also a bond bubble has occurred. That's corporate debt that looks pretty shaky right now in China. So private corporate debt and investor debt, bond bubble debt, speculative debt, and all that is significant. Now, China also got approved to have its currency as part of by the IMF as part of global trading currency, and to protect that, it's been engaging in this massive attempt to stabilize the currency, prevent it from devaluing further. So that's a major development. The property bubble and other rotating bubbles, insolvent state-owned enterprises, excess liquidity, corporate debt, capital flight, etc. All that has been important developments in China, and it appears it's not going to change going into next year. We're going to see continuation of that kind of rotating instability. Okay, another key event was by the central bank in Europe, the European Central Bank. It deepened its QE, deepened, in other words, injected even more money, buying not only government bonds, but buying up corporate bonds. In other words, they couldn't buy enough. There weren't enough bonds, and they were buying mostly Northern Europe, German bonds, and so forth, when they should be buying peripheries, Southern periphery, Italian bonds, et cetera. It doesn't have the effect that it should have had. But nonetheless, the ECB deepened its QE and its money injections. It starts out the year as more of a true central bank in the past, reforms over the last 4 or 5 years taking effect. But still got a problem there with excess QE and injections going on. The other main event, another main event of the past year is the realization that the Italian and European banks are in deep doo-doo. Italian banks in particular have over $400 billion in non-performing loans. And at the top of the public visibility on that issue is the oldest bank in the world called Monte dei Paschi, and three other major Italian banks, all in deep trouble. They tried to get a private bailout arranged earlier in the year, but the Italian referendum, where the people shut down the attempt by the economic elites to centralize more power recently here, put that kibosh on that. So now there's a big issue here of how these banks in Italy are going to be bailed out, because if they don't, there's big contagion potential here. Particularly French banks are heavily involved in loaning to these banks in Italy, but German banks as well, but especially the French. So if the Italian banks go over, it's a chain reaction to what would happen to some of the main French banks. And then, you know, it spreads everywhere. So a big event of the past year was this past summer, realizing that the Italian and European banks, even Deutsche Bank is in trouble, are real financial instability spots in the global economy and need to be watched very closely in 2017. Right. That's another reason why the ECB, the European Central Bank, will continue to, I predict, inject more liquidity into the European system economy, as well as for reasons of unknown economic impacts of political instability that may be coming with elections in Europe. But we'll talk about that if we can get to that political predictions as well. Okay, the UK economy, the British economy, post-Brexit, growing increasingly weak at a slow pace. The real estate bubble that had propped up UK economic growth prior to the Brexit vote here of last June now is unwinding, has unwound and continues, right? Financial sector is bleeding. The banks, a lot of global banks that, you know, London was the global banking center for derivatives in particular, are now moving to the continent, moving to Paris, moving to Frankfurt. So that's going to have a big effect on the UK economy. Real estate bubble burst, that growth effect, and the slow bleeding of the financial sector as it moves offshore. Jobs, problem of jobs and wages, and of course their currency, the pound, has declined significantly, which raises import inflation. And a big battle going on there between the UK economic elites and the Eurozone elites led by Germany as to how to carry out this Brexit, Brexit meeting where the British exit the European Union, the customs union, the goods and services union. That remains to be seen how it's done. Some over there believe that, well, let's just drag it all out, and if we drag it out, maybe it'll go away and we won't have to do it. Yeah, it doesn't matter that the people voted, you know, they're not important. So we're going to, let's just drag, go slow on this, you know. But the slower you go, the more uncertainty there is, and the more it affects business. And, of course, the Europeans want to do it quickly because they want to ensure that businesses relocate back to the continent there. Okay, so the UK economy post-Brexit, we'll see what happens there. Negative interest rates was a big issue last year. Negative rates, over $14 trillion in global negative interest rates. Bank non-performing loans, $3 to $5 trillion in non-performing loans. Big issues. Of course, negative rates are not an issue now because as U.S. raises rates, it allows rates in Japan and Europe to at least come up to the zero or slightly above level. But the bank non-performing loans is a big issue. We've got over $1 trillion, trillion and a half maybe, over there in Europe, maybe $1 trillion in Japan. India, non-performing bank loans are a big issue as well. So we're going to have to see what happens with India banks and non-performing loans. But that could be an issue as well. Looking at Japan, what do we have here? Well, Japan Abenomics policy has totally failed, and now the public and everyone's beginning to realize that that's the case. And the Prime Minister there, Abe, Shinzo Abe, is sort of at the beginning of what to do next, right? Well, what he's going to do next, I believe, and what these meetings with Obama and Trump are really about, is Japan's going to remilitarize. they're going to try to stimulate their economy with defense spending. And it seems to be an appropriate timing for them to do so, and I'll explain why. But the U.S., which always controlled foreign policy of Japan, particularly on the military side, will now allow them, well, this is more of a prediction, I guess, allow them to engage in fiscal spending because the massive QE, most massive anywhere, given the size of their economy, of any of the advanced economies, is Japan, the Bank of Japan. And the Bank of Japan's not only buying government bonds long ago, but corporate bonds for a long time now, and stocks, buying up stocks. In other words, keeping the prices up of these financial assets of the rich so that they don't that they can continue to make financial profits, right? And they even got Japanese government pension funds and so forth to buy stocks. So they're really desperately propping up financial assets over there to keep their economic elite afloat. And that elite is not investing in Japan and won't raise wages for its workers. They're sending the money offshore and investing elsewhere around the world. The rise of U.S. interest rates in the dollar has also lowered the Japanese currency, the yen, finally. And it's getting a little bit of a export a boost out of that as well. But it's not the export increase is not being passed on to workers, no wage increase, no real asset investment going on in Japan. All right. Latin American recessions deepen. And instability deepens on and off. Latin America, particularly major economies, Argentina, Brazil, Venezuela, Mexico, are really a reflection of what happens with the U.S. economy. And as U.S. interest rates rise, what happens is foreign direct investment of dollars into Latin America slows down, and capital flight flows out of these economies to the higher rates and opportunities back in the advanced economies, particularly the U.S. Well, when that happens, when you have capital flight, you have currency collapse. When you have currency collapse, you have import inflation. And when you have currency collapse and import inflation, the domestic central banks in those countries raise their interest rates, and that slows down their economies and creates deeper recessions. And that's been the story in Latin America. Now, when it looked like the Fed was not going to raise rates after Brexit and so forth, the pressure gets reduced, and capital flight slows, and foreign direct investment goes back, increases. So it's been a kind of a seesaw thing going on in Latin America. Capital flight on and off, currency decline down and up, et cetera. That kind of a seesaw is going to continue, and it will be more of off than on. In other words, as interest rates rise in the U.S., which they're going to continue to do, the only question is what is the rate and pace. Capital flight will continue to flow out of Latin America as their recessions deepen, and that's going to produce increasing political instability in Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, and places like that. Another major development of the past year is this massive corporate debt bubble that's been growing globally. But particularly in emerging markets, it's been borrowing and bond issuance in dollars, particularly in Latin America, the dollarization of debt in China as well, more domestic. In the U.S., corporations by the trillions are issuing bonds and so forth, commercial paper and everything, raising cash because interest rates are so low for so long. And actually, as the Fed indicates, it's going to raise rates. It's accelerated the bond issuances in order to lock in the low rates. The problem is all this corporate debt, which has increased by maybe $30 trillion. I'm talking about corporate-only debt since 2009. You know, excess debt at the heart of a lot of the problems, over-leveraging in 2008-9. Well, it's accelerated even further, much, much faster than government debt and household debt, and that's the big problem. A lot of this corporate debt now is sitting on corporate balance sheets, and it's got to be paid. And if we have a slowdown and decline in of income growth for businesses and corporations or prices, then where are they going to pay? How are they going to pay that massive increase in debt on their books? If they can't pay, then it's default. And if it's default, then their stock prices and other assets can collapse, and you risk a contagion effect across financial asset markets. And that's the road to the next financial instability event. Okay, U.S. economy the past year, what can we say about that? Well, we started out with a collapse of GDP. It looked really, really dangerous here at the beginning of the year. It looked like another recession was in the works. Well, it turned out to be just the fourth relapse, one quarter decline, because the Fed then continued to inject excess liquidity into the economy to keep it afloat from collapsing. In the first quarter, also, it looked like China was in deep trouble with its financial markets and declining and instability over there. And, of course, that's when global oil prices also declined. Those two are not unrelated, of course, China and global commodity and oil prices. In the U.S. economy, we had also a decline, and it became clear that productivity growth and investment, real investment in the U.S., was in deep trouble, declining to virtually nothing, business investment and productivity. And if you've got declining productivity, guess what businesses do? They don't give any wage increases. In fact, they find ways to cut wages, hire more part-time people, temp people, gig people, right? And that's what they've been doing. And that's why all these, quote, jobs that the Obama administration has been bragging about are all low-pay temp, kind of temporary jobs, service jobs. They're not real jobs. We're still way below manufacturing and construction employment here prior to the 2008 crash. Mm-hmm. The decline of the U.S. economy and the problems in emerging markets also gives impetus to the Federal Reserve not to raise rates at the beginning of the year, because when you have problems offshore here, U.S. multinational corporations, if you've got currency devaluations, collapses, and so forth, it means that their profit reporting collapses. You can think about the Federal Reserve as being super reluctant to raise interest rates, because when they do that, they have a big effect on U.S. global multinational corporations' offshore profits, and they get a huge percent of their total profits, like 40% from offshore operations. So the Fed was protecting multinational corporations to some extent. Okay. First quarter collapse of the U.S. economy was a notable event. Fourth quarter, of course, we have the Fed rate shift, and we have in between the U.S. elites slowly drifting towards the realization that they've squeezed the monetary policy as much as they can to enrich their investor and corporate friends, and now it was time to shift to fiscal policy, and the talk is infrastructure. That was growing throughout the election campaign here, and now we see it as a major topic in the new Trump administration. What it means, we still do not know. I think it's going to mean more or less token government spending on infrastructure, but a lot of government subsidies and credits to private sector, and massive tax cuts that they're going to claim are infrastructure projects. Massive tax cuts for corporations, you see. That's what they mean by infrastructure spending. That and subsidies and credits and so forth. It's going to be a very private kind of a thing. Don't think of it as the government saying, okay, we're going to rebuild our roads and our railroad network and airports and stuff. No. People are going to really be disappointed when they see what this infrastructure thing is. Right? Mostly tax cuts, I predict here. But anyway, the thought of it, or the possibility or misinterpretation of what it means, it's not really fiscal spending, but everyone knew anything about the economy realized that the monetary policy had run its route. It had massively enriched U.S. investors. Stock market tripled, bond markets doubled. You know, who knows what derivative markets produced in terms of income for investors, because no one knows that. They don't show that. Anyway, you know, massive income redistribution occurred because of zero interest rates and all the QE and so forth. But that had run its course, was destabilizing the economy. And so the elites are turning now to this fiscal stimulus effect. Now, I'm going to predict that I don't think long-term it's going to have any more real effect than the monetary policy has. All right, but we'll see that. We'll talk more about that in predictions here shortly. So this drift towards fiscal spending infrastructure of the last year, notable, as well as the collapse in the first quarter and the fourth quarter Fed and the stock market bubble. What we got with rising interest rates is the bond bubble from all this Fed QE, private and corporate, right, low interest rates. All this, the bond bubble started to unwind. And where did the money go? Well, it went into stocks. Because of the euphoria predicting, well, we're going to get a fiscal stimulus here and tax cuts. Let's invest in these companies that are going to benefit from infrastructure, however defined. And, of course, a lot of money flowing back now into U.S. Financial markets, stock markets in particular, from the emerging markets and from Europe. Because the interest rates affected, the spread is over 2% between European bonds and U.S. bonds. So the money flows back to the U.S. So you get this picture, you know, the bond, U.S. bond market bubble unwinds and the money flows, you know, out of mutual funds and so forth and flows into U.S. stocks. And we get this big 20,000 Dow and records in NASDAQ and records in the S&P 500 markets. Right. Well, the money, that's money demand flowing on, you know, all the money that was sitting on the sidelines and the unwinding bond markets. So the money flows into stocks within the U.S. and money flows back, capital flight, from emerging markets and from Europe as we get the difference in the spreads. Okay, so that's fueling, and we got euphoria. You know, this stock market thing is all bet. On this excess money flows, you know, the assumption that fiscal spending is going to really stimulate the U.S. economy, I don't believe so, because I don't believe tax cuts create jobs and create real investment. It just enriches investors, that's all, as they redirect their money into financial assets or elsewhere. Outside the U.S., or just sit on it, which was a major theme and argument of my book, Systemic Fragility, as well. All this liquidity injection, 10 to 15 trillion in the U.S. alone, where did it go? It didn't go into real investment, creating real jobs and hiring real people at decent pay. It went into financial asset markets. You know, it went offshore while the boom occurred in emerging markets. and it went to sit on their balance sheet, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars just sitting idle there. And now, of course, it's going into the market. But it's a euphoria, and it won't last very long, you know. There'll be a six-month holiday in 2017 where things are going to, you know, in anticipation will look good. But I think it's going to peter out by the end of next year, and I will predict a recession in the U.S. In 2018, maybe even as early as late 2017, but we'll see. Okay, you know, a lot of this boosting of financial speculation and financial asset values, stocks, bonds, etc., rotating here in the U.S. Has resulted in massive, massive capital gains and income gains for the wealthiest 1% households, while wage incomes have stagnated or declined as people get dumped from higher-paid manufacturing and construction jobs into low-paid service jobs, temp jobs, part-time jobs, gig economy jobs. Now, you know, all of this is depressing. Depressing wages, and of course, the labor movement, union movement, has been all but destroyed in the U.S., so it has virtually no effect anymore on wages. So wages stagnate or decline, while all these capital gains, incomes, you know, dividends, as I said before on the show, U.S. corporations alone have paid out over $5 trillion in dividends and stock buybacks, $5 trillion since 2010. Massive. Well, you know, that's going to, and you have wage stagnation on the other end. So we get economists at UC Berkeley, Emmanuel Saez, in other words, who have this ELSA database, they call it, of world income based on IRS data in other countries and so forth. For the first time, you can slice and dice that data by percents and tenths of percents and hundreds of percents. And in the U.S., at the beginning of the year, the report was that the wealthiest 1% households, who all invest, right, these are millionaires and above, have accrued 97% of all the income gains since 2010. 97% have gone to the 1%. Right? So we the rest of us, 99%, get to distribute the other 3%, which is up from 65% during the George Bush years, and that was up from 48% during the Clinton years. So we have accelerating income inequality going on. Right? And now we're going to get these massive, massive tax cuts here, trillions and trillions more after Bush and Obama gave them trillions, corporations and investors. They're going to get trillions more now. And they're going to reduce the dividend rates and the income tax rates, get rid of inheritance taxes, et cetera. And all this can translate into even more. Maybe next time they'll get 101%. Yeah. Well, income inequality is going to continue in the U.S. And the bond bubble's unwinding and the stock bubbles are rising. Other important developments, of course, are the pharmaceutical companies last year price gouging us to no limit, and Congress talking about it, not doing anything about it. U.S. dollar rising as well. So these are the main events: dollar rising, pharmaceutical, and of course health insurance costs also rising now through in 2016, along with massive increases in pharmaceutical prices. Of course, they're both related. When you get these massive pharmaceutical price increases, the insurance companies raise their premiums and so forth, and the prescription drug pharmacies and companies put more and more of this stuff off their formularies, as they call it, and they don't carry them, or you pay for all of it, et cetera. So it's, you know, massive increases here in healthcare costs, out-of-pocket costs. Now, you know, the U.S. government says, oh, well, health cost spending has declined. Well, yeah, people are foregoing using it, you know, or they're buying insurance packages that have $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 annual deductibles, you know, which is just, you know, you only have insurance if you get cancer and you're about to die, right? And that means they, you know, the Obamacare has collapsed under the weight of that lack of control of health inflation. Okay, so just to sum up once again, real quickly, key economic events of the past year: global trade stagnation, the Fed rate increase, stabilization of oil and commodity prices, renewed property bubbles and financial instability in China, the European Central Bank, massive QE continuing, Italy and Eurozone banks looking like in trouble, the UK economy slowing post-Brexit, negative rates for most of the year, then reversed. Bank non-performing loans increase. Japan Abenomics fails. Oh, I forgot to mention, watch out for most recently here in Japan, news coming out about the bankruptcy, insolvency of the giant company Toshiba. If Toshiba, goes under, it will have a significant effect on the financial system in Japan and elsewhere. Okay, so Japan Abenomics, Bank of Japan, continuing more and more QE and then holding off at the very end of the year because Fed rate increases will take that pressure off. Latin American recessions growing deeper, corporate global debt bubble growing, and the U.S. economy, which, you know, the shift towards fiscal spending talk, first quarter collapse, fourth quarter Fed rate increase, growing income inequality, bond bubble unwinding, stock bubble rising, and then healthcare, pharmaceutical costs, and so forth in the U.S. dollar. These are all major events of last year. So what's the predictions? What are my predictions for the coming year for the U.S. and global economy? One, the economic euphoria we are now experiencing reflected in financial markets, stock markets, and so forth. So we'll continue for another 6 months, but then reality will set in. And it will become clear that all this expectation of fiscal stimulus growth 3% plus that Trump is supposed to bring and bring back jobs and all that is not going to happen. You're not going to get the boost in jobs from this infrastructure program, which I predict is going to be heavily tax cut, business tax cut oriented. As I've said elsewhere on my blog, jackrasmus.com, Trump is not against free trade. He's against multilateral free trade. He wants to bilaterally, country by country, renegotiate these deals. But free trade is free trade. And he's going to make it look like he's doing something about jobs, but by this jawboning, as they say, of individual companies like he has with Ford and Carrier and so forth. You know, he'll get a lot of publicity there. It looked like it's early happening. Those things are just a drop in the bucket to the continued loss of jobs. He's not going to impose big tariffs on any of these countries. He's going to put on the back burner doing anything about NAFTA and so forth while they push what they really want, which is these big tax cuts, you see. The Fed will continue to raise interest rates. It will have a devastating effect, I predict, on housing and autos. Already housing is in trouble, and autos have peaked. I think auto and housing, two major sectors of the economy, are going to slope significantly in the coming year. The U.S. dollar will continue to drift upward and rise as rates increase, right? We're going to see a big attack on union labor coming, particularly at the state level. Open shop is going to expand. The NLRB is going to take an anti-union turn, and in general, we're going to see at the state level, the Republicans mostly now control a lot of anti-union initiatives. The union movement in America is almost dead. Certainly, as an effective political force, it is not existent now, the attack is going to continue. We're going to see bilateral free trade agreements by Trump. We're going to see a big concession to tech companies. He's going to give them more H-1B visas. In other words, bring more skilled people over here, take high-paying jobs, you know, from Asia in particular, that U.S. Workers could have. Just the opposite of his talk, you know, about trade and so forth. Financial deregulation is coming. The Obamacare is going to be gutted. Health insurance companies and drug companies will be able to raise their prices even further, right? And we're going to see an attempt to, as all these corporate tax cuts take a big whack out of the U.S. budget, and by the way, he's proposed, according to the Tax Policy Center, $6.2 trillion in tax cuts. And Ryan and those guys in Congress love that, and they're going to go for that, you know, immediately. And they're going to try to take it out of Social Security, Medicare. Medicaid is going to be rolled back significantly. Education is not going to get funded. And of course, the environment is going to suffer under this guy as well. Okay, so that all those things are my predictions for the U.S. economy, which will get a bump in the first half of the year, and that bump will dissipate later. And my prior prediction before Trump that we'd have a recession in the U.S. in 2017 has been lifted, and it's going to be 2018 now before that actually happens. Okay, and what about Europe? What do we see in Europe? Well, we're going to see more emerging market companies, more ECB QE occurring, right? Why? Well, because Europe continues to stagnate and the money's flowing out of Europe and is going to North America, but also unknown political instability. We have elections coming up in France, in Germany, in Netherlands, and these are extremely important elections, and it looks like the right wing is going to have an upper hand in these elections, and if they do, if the National Front in France wins and has a shot at it this time around, if it does win, well, you'll see the rapid unraveling of Europe and the European Union and Eurozone. But that's a big question mark. We don't know yet. I predicted 3 years ago that the European currency, the euro, would decline to parity to the dollar. At the time, the euro was $1.45 to the dollar, and I think it's now like $1.03 to the dollar. Well, that prediction came true. You can read my predictions of previous years on my blog, by the way, jackrasmus.com, if you're interested. But I predict the euro will fall to less than parity to the dollar next year. There will be significant disruptions next year in the banking system in Europe. Italian banks almost certainly will have to be bailed out by the ECB and the European Commission, and EU banks in general are in trouble. We may see emerging problems in banks in Spain again. BBVA in particular is going to take a hit here, right? And we're going to see more resistance by southern periphery European economies to the very strict fiscal spending austerity rules that Germany and its friends have required as part of the Eurozone deal that was negotiated in 1999. In other words, you can't spend a certain amount of your deficit in relationship to your deficit. Well, there's going to be a big push against that, particularly in places like Italy. And if we find the new parties, both left and right, come to power, they're going to turn more to infrastructure and fiscal spending as well. So in Europe, more QE, more currency devaluation, banking system problems, right? Capital flight to the U.S., all that will continue. How about Japan? Well, Japan's going to hold on. It's deepening its QE, which is the deepest of all the advanced economies, and it will shift to fiscal spending because it's got nothing else. It can't do anything else. Wages won't rise. Corporations ignoring any attempt to increase wages over there, and the monetary policy is not doing anything. Japan's got a little break here because the U.S. is raising rates, and it was not because of anything Abenomics has done. But this fiscal shift will be defense spending, not infrastructure spending. You know, Japan has engaged in massive infrastructure spending over the last decade, and it hasn't stimulated their economy, which should be a warning sign to all this infrastructure spending talk here in the U.S. You see, infrastructure spending can be long-term. It doesn't have much of an immediate effect on stimulating the economy, especially if it's capital intensive. And the more capital intensive it is, it may eliminate more jobs than it creates. It tends to create short-term jobs and eliminate long-term jobs. So, you know, it's really being hyped, all this infrastructure spending argument. But in the U.S., you know, a lot of it, as I said, will be tax cuts and subsidies and credits and so forth, which will parade this infrastructure spending. But by the end of the year, it's going to be clear that, you know, the impact from this is not really happening the way people had fantasized. And then the economy and consumption in the U.S. will take a hit. Okay. China prediction, continue rotating bubbles. The yuan will devalue. Right now it's at the top of its range, 6.97. Can't go any further unless there's an official allowing, government allows it to devalue further. China's trying to resist that, but the capital flight, they can't keep spending $1 trillion to prevent capital flight and stabilize financial markets. $1 trillion in currency reserves. I think they will allow the yuan to drift lower. In other words, the devaluation. The real economy in China is going to continue to slow at around 4%, which is the real growth rate, not the 6.7. Okay, well, that's not much of a slowing, 4%, right? but in any event, more of the same going on with a yuan currency devaluation for China. For Japan, more of the same, nothing working but a shift to defense spending and remilitarization. Europe, more of the same as far as ECB and quantitative easing and monetary policy and continued resistance to fiscal spending, but big bank problems over there, which are going to deepen, and resistance in the periphery economies is going to deepen. How about emerging markets? Well, as interest rates rise, we're going to get more capital flight, less money flowing into these markets, currency devaluation, import inflation, domestic interest rate increases, and deeper recessions. Global oil, I predict, will not go above $60-$62 a barrel. Latin America is going to be very hard hit economically and politically. It will follow as well, instability. Problems in South Korea as a result of the impeachment, Southeast Asia economies, Turkey, these are all emerging market economies to watch as well. Also, watch the banks and the non-performing loans in India. There's been some talk, some action about taking in certain currencies and converting them and so forth. Well, that's not the real issue. The real issue is non-performing bank loans in India. Okay, so that's our overview of the economy, the U.S. global economy, and our predictions for 2017. We didn't get to the political overview and predictions. We'll do that next week because they are tied in with these economic issues. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions, and next week, political events of the past year and predictions for the coming year as we come closer to the Trump administration taking over. This is Alternative Visions.